Good afternoon, Juno. It's a few seconds after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. It's time for Juno Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today. We've got a great lineup of guests today. Maybelle Filler from Sitka is going to be on in just a little bit after National Native News, telling us about some new mental health first aid training that's going to be available to the public. There'll be sessions here in Juneau on February 5th this year. And our other guests include the folks who are going to put on a DAR genealogy workshop this weekend. Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center has their second fireside lecture series of the thing, and it's going to be Lynn Schooler talking about Lituya Bay. And the Winter Wildlands Alliance Backcountry Film Festival is going to be in Juneau, and we'll have folks in here to tell us about that. All of that follows National Native News here on KTOO News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Protesters who drowned out a speech this week by a former national chief say he doesn't have their interests in mind. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, former national chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Phil Fontaine, is now working in the resource sector.
Fontaine was in Winnipeg to deliver a lecture at the University of Winnipeg's Convocation Hall. He was supposed to speak about the issue of resource extraction and development that balances the needs of Indigenous people, protects the environment, and allows for private sector engagement. But 2 minutes into his delivery, protesters began shouting and drumming, angry that Fontaine now works for oil and gas giant TransCanada and no longer represents First Nations interests. One of the protesters was Joe Sini.
How dare you sell us out to work with the enemy that's destroying this earth?
Sini says he and other protesters wanted to send a message of opposition to TransCanada. He says they are disgusted that Fontaine would actually work for the resource sector. Meanwhile, Robert Ouellette from a University Aboriginal Focus Program says the protest was a positive thing because it brings awareness to Aboriginal issues.
If it had just been a normal lecture, Phil would have talked for an hour and then it would have fallen by the wayside. We wouldn't remember in 2 months what had been said. But in this case, all Canadians are actually talking about this.
The president of the university called an end to the event and Fontaine was escorted from the room as supporters and protesters shouted at each other. The speech will be rescheduled. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A nonprofit community loan fund based on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation has expanded its target market to all enrolled members of federally recognized tribes who live in South Dakota. Jim Kent reports on the Four Bands Community Fund.
Prior to its expansion, Four Bands Community Fund was limited to serving clients within the boundaries of a reservation. Tanya Fiddler is the fund's executive director.
Our original mission was to serve the Native Americans and permanent residents of the Cheyenne River Reservation in order for us to stimulate economy with business development.
Despite the success of that mission over the years, the fund's leadership realized they were missing a substantial portion of a population in need.
So we thought it was going to be important to try to pilot some lending with our tribal members off reservation, especially Rapid City. The Native American population is around 15% or so, and over half that population lives below the poverty level.
Fiddler hopes to mirror the success the Four Bands Community Fund has had in creating businesses on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation to tribal members living in Rapid City, Pierre, and other parts of the state. Business and consumer loans paired with educational services are also now available to tribal members on reservations other than the Cheyenne River. Fiddler adds that the key to success so far has been bringing the Lakota values of risk-taking, courage, and wisdom to each new entrepreneur in order to help them to succeed. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs Office of Justice Services is holding tribal court training next week in New Mexico. The training program is to help improve the trial advocacy skills of tribal court prosecutors, defenders, and judges. The 2014 sessions will focus on case studies involving trafficking of illegal narcotics, domestic violence, and sexual assault, and a roundtable discussion on the Violence Against Women Act. Sessions will take place for 4 days in Albuquerque. Today we remember Native American ballerina Maria Tallchief, who was born on this day in 1925. The Osage woman's career included performances around the world. She was the prima ballerina for the New York City Ballet. Tallchief passed away at the age of 88 last year. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. The Convention and Tourism Department of the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce provides convention and event planning services for Native American organizations. Information at ahcnm.org. When you file online for your PFD, every Alaskan can support National Native News. Just use Pick, Click, Give and select KNBA-FM, Kawanak Broadcast Corporation. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's just about 5 seconds after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore hosting today for Juneau Afternoon. My first guest comes to us by telephone from Sitka. Mabel Filler is going to be coming up to Juneau, however. She'll be here Wednesday, February 5th, and will be here to administer some mental health first aid training. Hello, Mabel.
Hi. Good afternoon, everyone.
Yeah, welcome we're having a foggy kind of misty day here in Juneau with the sun peeping out now. It was foggy this morning. What you got down in Sitka?
We've got bright, sunny skies. Oh. It is awesome.
All right. Well, you don't want to leave then, right?
Well, I think the moment I said that, the weather might change.
Okay.
Don't hate me, everybody.
No. Oh, well. So mental first health first aid training.
Yes.
We're familiar with, doing the CPR on the dummies and that sort of thing, but this must be a different kind of training entirely.
Yes, it is. It's really the same thought process, delivering a basic course that's non-clinical in focus to people to help overcome any stigmas related to mental illness and substance abuse, and reduce any sort of non-knowledge or unawareness of those kinds of issues. And it's basically a state initiative to try to bring into focus the importance of not only the physical nature of people, but their mental wellness as well.
Now, you're giving this, you're administering a class down in Juneau first.
Yes.
And that one, we should just say, if anyone wants to take it down there, is on January 29th at the University of Alaska Southeast campus down there.
It's in Sitka.
Yes, in Sitka.
On January 29th.
Yes, and then you're coming up here on the 5th.
Yes, the following week. And the one in Juneau is a partnership with JAMI and Juneau Alliance for the Mentally Ill, I believe. They are also, we're also partnered with the Training Trust Cooperative, and I took my training from the Alaska Primary Care Association. They really sponsored a lot of their partners to take this training statewide. That's how important they felt to have mental health first aid training. And actually, we were the first state to actually have 100% participation from all the Alaska primary care folks.
Wow.
And actually, it just came through the news that through the bipartisan efforts of our U.S. Senator, Mark Begich, and Kelly Ayotte from New Hampshire, there is $15 million that's going to be brought to the mental health first aid training. And in fact, there's a scheduled training for Senate staffers on Capitol Hill. So nationwide, it's really bringing into focus this initiative, this awareness that when people suffer a crisis, we don't want to further have their feeling of isolation. We want to be present for them. We want to help them. We want to provide what we can. We're not experts, and this course is really a basic course in providing mental health first aid, and it's trying to understand its impact and be that advocate, be that community awareness for mental health wellness for our community.
So, Mabel, the course takes the form of an interactive 8-hour certification process.
Yes, exactly. Very interactive. And really, you know, that is the best way that we have found that participants learn the basics of this training course. And we make it fun, and it's definitely a full 8 hours. But what we've found is that people have felt very empowered when they leave, and they have felt that they can really use this in their work sites, in their personal lives, and in fact, it's a big grassroots effort. That's been the amazing part of it.
So this is from 8:30 to 5 on Wednesday, February 5th here in Juneau, and you're doing this at the Clinkett and Haida Vocational Training Center over on Hospital Drive.
Yes, 3239 Hospital Drive, and the one in Sitka is at the UAS Sitka campus.
And people have to pre-register for this because of the size of the classes and like that. About how many people can take the course?
Well, we've capped it at 25, we still have spots available. We have about 10 or 15 spots available here in Sitka, and we have about 15 spots available in Juneau. And what's great is that we really strongly believe in mental health wellness and its connection to how a person takes care of their overall health care. I work for the diabetes program at Search, and we know that if a person's not feeling well, they're not going to be present. They're not going to even care or be motivated to taking care of their chronic disease, let alone if it's just no chronic disease at all. And so that's why we're involved. And so if people are interested and if they feel that the registration fee of $75 is prohibitive or challenging for them, contact me. And we would love to help with that cost. That's how much we believe in this and how much we want this community to really take part. And for providers that want to take part and want to have CEUs, there are CEUs that are available. And again, this is not a clinical course. This is a basic course. So please keep that in mind, folks. But we really welcome anybody who has experienced a difficulty in trying to help someone who is dealing with a crisis. They want to help, but they just don't know how, or they don't feel they can help them. This is the course for you. Either in your workplace, in your personal life, this is the course for you. And you may never use it, or you may use it, but at least you have the tools. You have the choice. And isn't that really great?
It is. I'm really excited about the opportunity. Mabel, there's a registration process that people have to go through. They have to go to a website in order to get registered for the class?
Yes, they do. Mm-hmm. And the website is a long one, but what you can do is contact me at 907-966-8739, and I'd be happy to connect you and help you with that process. The other way to get a hold of me is through my email, and that's maif@searhc.org.
That sounds like a wonderful way to do this, because I'm looking at this address and everything, and it looks like you have to go through a class registration process.
Exactly, and I can help that along. And really, folks, if you are not able to attend either dates, guess what? We will have more training dates available. Just keep your eyes open, because we know that, especially in certain sites that are larger than most, like Juneau and Anchorage, there are waiting lists that are there, and it fills up rather quickly. I'm hopeful that this one will also fill up quickly. It usually does. And again, folks, please consider attending. If you've ever been in a situation where you want to help and someone's in crisis and you don't know how to help, and maybe the more immediate help is not as immediately available, this is the course for you.
So if the mental health first aid excuse me. If the mental health first aid training sounds like it's the thing you want to do, you can contact Mabel at 966. I'm sorry, it's area code 907. She's in Sitka. 966-8739. Or you can email her at maif@searhc.org. and she'll walk you through the registration process, and there's even the possibility of some scholarship help if the $75 fee is a problem.
Exactly. And if folks are wondering about the long-distance charges, you can call up the Search Hospital, and they can connect that way.
So is there there's an 800 number for that?
I don't know it offhand, okay. But the Search Hospital number is 463-4040, or it might be 364-4040.
Okay. The Search Hospital here in Juneau.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, okay.
And then they can connect folks to me through their system.
Great. Hey, thank you so much for letting us know about this opportunity for folks to take advantage of. It's, again, on Wednesday, February 5th, here in Juneau at the Clinkett and Haida Vocational Training Center. Contact Mabel if you need a little assistance getting signed up for the thing.
Okay, well, thank you very much for inviting me today.
Hey, my pleasure.
I hope everybody has a great weekend.
Hey,
it's
going to
be a beautiful weekend.
Get out in that Sitka sunshine.
I sure will.
You
thank
bet.
You.
Uh-huh.
Bye.
Six Guitars. They're going to be here in town on Monday, January 27th at 7:30 p.m. They're going to be in the TMHS Auditorium. These are the California and Montreal guitar trios joined together in a wonderful performance that the Juneau Arts and Humanities folks are bringing up here for part of their 40th year. Everything from tangos, which we just heard a little bit of, surf rock, gunfighter ballads, the Bohemian Rhapsody. Each trio's fretboards chase the other's original compositions and new arrangements of progressive rock, world, jazz, and classical music. So it's going to be a good concert. You might want to call up and see if there's still tickets. I'm sure there are. But it's called the 6x6 String Phenomen Ensemble, and it's going to be Monday night, January 27th, 7:30 p.m. in the TMHS Auditorium. My next guest is also coming into the studio by telephone. Regina Falace is going to be leading a workshop Saturday from 3 to 4 in the afternoon at the Valley Library. And this is a genealogy workshop being put on by the Daughters of the American Revolution. Hello, Regina. Regina, are you there? Oh,
thank
Regina.
You so much for having me here.
There
today.
You are. I didn't find you for a second. Now I've got you. So this is a genealogy workshop. I'm remembering back to when my mother got interested in the genealogy of our family and it involved writing literally hundreds of letters to people and collecting books and pictures and everything else, trying to things down. It's a little easier now, isn't it?
Oh, it's a lot easier. And thank goodness. We're so fortunate to have the internet and all the computer resources that exist, especially here in Juneau, being the capital. We have our wonderful library system. And at the library, you can access things as a patron, such as Ancestry.com and Heritage Quest and Alaska Genealogy. So it's a much easier process these days than writing off and wondering when you'll ever hear a reply.
So what will you be covering in the workshop?
Well, tomorrow I will cover some of the basics. Of course, you always start with what you know, but I'll also include other things that people might not be aware of, such as some of the websites that contain free information. And free is always great because genealogy can add up quickly. But if you know how to find some of that free information, it can make your life a lot happier. And certainly the information is always fun to find out. Tomorrow, I'll share with everyone some of the resources available here locally, as well as through the internet at research facilities that are throughout the country. So I hope that everyone who can come will enjoy it and ask lots of questions. One thing that you can't replicate on the internet is having the opportunity to ask someone questions, and that's also what I hope to be able to address for people tomorrow.
Is how to interview someone for information, is that what?
No.
Oh.
Well, I could cover that, but what I meant specifically by my comment was if they had questions like, I'm stuck, what do I do now?
Mm-hmm.
Then I could help guide them to what step they should take next, or some ideas at least.
Regina, have you traced your own genealogy?
I have. I got started in seventh grade with my history teacher's project. She assigned everyone to do the family tree, and I've been working on it since then, and I just love it. I've been very successful at getting back into the 1500s on many of my branches, and I just find it very fascinating.
Who's your most interesting predecessor?
Oh, gosh, that's a hard one. I would say I'll be biased. Because I'm a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution, my Patriot ancestor who helped in the American Revolution is my favorite. And his name was Martin Heffelfinger. And Heffelfinger is my maiden name. It was a Swiss name. And he came to this country as a child, only 8 years old when he arrived in Philadelphia. And when he grew up, the family folklore is that he helped supply the troops at Valley Forge.
Hmm.
And I've also found him on a list of oath takers. He took an oath of allegiance to the new country.
A fascinating little bit of personal history. And can I ask you how you found that?
Well, two different ways. One, getting started at such a young age certainly gave me time to work on it. And just keep working through finding different archives, repositories. Much of my work was done before the internet came along, so I had to write off many, many letters and wait for replies. But then with the introduction of the internet, I got to speed things up a bit and get responses more quickly and find things sometimes that other people have posted on the internet. Whether it's an archive facility or another individual who turned out to be a distant cousin of some sort. I think the biggest caveat you have to remember when you find someone else's posted tree on the internet is that you have to take it with a grain of salt. Some of the information might not be accurate, so it's always important to verify what you find.
Regina, how many people can attend comfortably? You're in that meeting room, I think, in the back of the library, the glass
That's
front on it.
Right. We are in the meeting room at the Mendenhall Bailey Library tomorrow afternoon. I would say between 20 and 30.
Okay.
And there's no registration necessary. Just show up. If you can't make it for some reason, I'd be happy to email you a copy of the program.
You better move your cell phone. I think you're dropping out of the cell phone coverage.
Oh, sorry about that.
Perfect.
Okay.
Yeah.
For people who can't make it tomorrow or if the room fills up, I'd be happy to email the program to them after the fact. But I think 20 to 30 should be a list in the room.
Should people bring anything if they're coming?
Yes, actually you should. bring some things that you want to work on. If you know some of your basics, such as your information, who your parents are, your grandparents, and if you can get farther back than that, then jot those notes down too. And then you can continue from there.
Okay, so any notes that you might have, well, don't bring the big box in the bookcase.
Oh, no, yeah.
Let's get it down to something we can carry in and out of the library easily.
That's right.
And
that's right.
A problem if you have one or someplace that you might be going with. But if you haven't even started at all, are you going to come down to the basics of, okay, so here's the first move?
Yes, I will. I'll start with a very basic first step.
Good. This is from 3 to 4 in the afternoon on Saturday at the Valley Library. It's in the big meeting room in the back. Regina Falace will be leading a genealogy workshop sponsored by the Daughters of the American Revolution. The workshop is free, and there will be plenty of time for questions and answers and hopefully the chance to maybe work on something that you might be in the middle of trying to figure out how you get around one more generation back and that kind of thing.
That's right. Thank you, Pat.
Okay. Well, thank you. It sounds like a really fascinating afternoon, and I hope people take advantage of the opportunity to work with a professional in the field.
Oh, thank you. I hope so, too. Bye-bye.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 24th of January, 2014. It's the birthday of the novelist Edith Wharton, New York City, 1862, came from a rich New York family living off their real estate and banking fortune. Edith grew up around 23rd and Park Avenue. She read books from the family's great library, felt odd in high society. At the age of 23, she entered into a long and miserable marriage with a family friend, a good-looking guy, Teddy Wharton. Didn't care for books, had extravagant tastes, had numerous affairs. Edith Wharton went to Europe to escape from him, and she met Henry James in Europe and became good friends with him. He encouraged her to write about the New York City that she knew so well and that she disliked so much. And it was Henry James who introduced her to his friend Morton Fullerton, a journalist in Paris. Edith Wharton fell in love with him, had a long, passionate affair with him when she was in her late 40s, and she moved to Paris to be closer to him, though the affair ended soon after. She loved living in Paris. She got to know André Gide and Jean Cocteau. Theodore Roosevelt, F. Scott Fitzgerald came and visited her. She felt rather old-fashioned in the literary world. She did not approve of James Joyce's Ulysses. Died in Paris at the age of 75, working on a novel, lay in bed in her last days, writing it page by page, dropping each page onto the floor so it could be collected later. Edith Wharton, who said there are two ways of spreading light, to be the candle or to be the mirror that receives it. It's the birthday of the zoologist Desmond Morris, born in Purton, England, in 1928. He had studied and written about chimpanzees and other animals, and then he decided to write a book about human behavior as he had written about animal behavior. It was called The Naked Ape. It was an enormous bestseller in 1967. It's the birthday of the playwright William Congreve, West Yorkshire, England, 1670, author of the Restoration comedy The Way of the World, in which he created sayings that we still might use today. Heaven has no rage like love to hatred turned, nor hell a fury like a woman scorned. Music hath charms to soothe the savage breast, wrote William Congreve. And it was he who said, thus grief still treads upon the heels of pleasure. Married in haste, we may repent at leisure. Here's a poem for today by Ann Porter, Getting Up Early. Just as the night was fading into the dusk of morning, when the air was cool as water, when the town was quiet, and I could hear the sea. I caught sight of the moon, no higher than the rooftops, our neighbor, the moon. An hour before the sunrise, she glowed with her own sunrise, gold in the gray of morning. World without town or forest, without wars or sorrows, she paused between two trees, and it was as if, in secret, not wanting to be seen, she chose to visit us so early in the morning. Getting Up Early by Ann Porter, from her collection An Altogether Different Language, published by Zoland Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 28 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next guest is good author, great writer, who writes really exciting books about Alaska. Lynn Schooler is here. He's, among other things, he's walked up about half the coast of southeast Alaska and parked his boat in Lituya Bay while he was doing that. And tonight at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, Lynn's going to show us some pictures and tell us some stories about Lituya Bay, which is a really interesting place in southeast Alaska.
It is one of the more dynamic and striking places I've ever been in southeast Alaska, and it's got a lot of just shocking stories. We decided to title the talk tonight Lituya Bay, a Magical Enigma, and it's an enigma because it's probably one of the most beautiful places I've ever been on the planet, but it's got a long, long history of killing people. You know, it sits right on the Fairweather Fault, and in 1958, there was an 8.8 moment magnitude quake that dropped 90 million tons of debris from the side of the mountain at the back of the fjord, and it caused the largest wave ever recorded on the planet. You know, 1,720 feet high, that stripped away 4 square miles of timber in a matter of minutes. And amazingly, there were 3 boats, 3 trollers anchored in the harbor, and 2 of the crews actually survived that tsunami and all the debris. And it was just an incredible story how they managed to leave there alive after, just as one of the captains of the trollers put it, all hell broke loose. Yeah. But it's just a magic place, and I hope everybody gets a chance to at least visit it briefly.
Now, the first white people who entered Lituya Bay were a group of French explorers.
Well, that was La Perouse.
Yeah. You know,
and that was in the 1700s.
Sent here by Louis the 16th.
La Perouse sailed in there after Captain Cook and Vancouver had explored the coast of Alaska, but was the first person to actually enter Lituya, first westerner to enter Lituya Bay. It was very well known to the Tlingit. There were seasonal settlements in there and quite a lot of hunting and trading. It was a major stopover for people traveling up and down the coast. And the Tlingit legend has it that Lituya Bay is inhabited by a malevolent spirit they call Kalutuya, who kept giant brown bears as his slaves. And whenever Kalutuya was upset about something, he'd send his slaves down to the water to grab it in their jaws and give it a shake. And this is it's a metaphor for numerous earthquakes and rock slides and tsunamis that have been generated in there.
The Fairweather Fault stretches from roughly Yakutat down?
The Fairweather Fault runs for about 150 miles down the coast from Yakutat to Cape Spencer, but mm-hmm. then it just joins into another network of faults and cracks that extends all the way down and becomes part of the San Andreas Fault.
And so this
it's where the North American Plate, which is all of North America all the way over, including Greenland, is grinding up against the Pacific Plate, which underlies all of the Pacific. And they're rotating in opposite directions. So you got two of the biggest pieces of the Earth's crust grinding along each other there, and that's why we have the Fairweather Range and all the way up into the Alaska Range. But that's a lot of energy, and when it cuts loose, it's violent is hardly an adequate word.
Wow. The force that we're describing here, it's easy to throw those numbers out, but 1,720 feet is like 400 feet higher than the Twin Towers were.
I'm not sure how far, what the altitude of the cross up here on Mount Roberts is, but I think it's like 400 or 500 feet higher than the cross. So if you've ever ridden the tram up Mount Roberts and then hiked up onto Gold Peak, that's how high the mountain was stripped of all the timber down to bare rock.
So here's the water at sea level, and then 1,750 feet high, or 20 feet higher than that is when the wave crests, and that's the point at which it scoured the rocks inside Lituya Bay right down to bedrock, took everything off.
The USGS geologist named Don Miller, who was a pioneering geologist all along that coast through the 50s and 60s, and had been there days before the quake studying records of previous tsunamis. And he calculated that it was about 90 million tons of rock that fell half a mile down the side of the mountain.
Sheared off the front of a mountain.
But that alone didn't explain the size and energy and mass of the wave and the damage it did. And it was actually not very well understood until a university in Switzerland built a replica of Lituya Bay and reproduced the rock slide. And saw that what happened was the rock struck so violently that it blew a big wall of water away so fast that it couldn't fill in back around the slide like you'd normally think of the slide. Mm-hmm. And I've got a video tonight. If we have time, we'll actually see that experiment on video. But if you just think about when you're playing in the pool and you slap your palm out in front of you and the water can fly 15 or 20 feet, that's sort of the similar reaction, only this was a 90 million ton palm. Yeah.
Now, Ulrich, the guy who was in there
one
with
his son,
they'd gone in and anchored down for the night.
Yeah.
He tried to pull the anchor out, but probably the theory is that maybe the shifting had actually locked his anchor up. And so he powered the boat out so that he could face the oncoming wave.
Yeah, he was thinking pretty fast because when he couldn't get his anchor winch up, he just let the winch run, so it spooled out all of the chain and cable that was left on it and gave him some maneuverability. And his objective was to try to get out into the middle of Lituya Bay where the water is still 600 or 700 feet deep because waves break in shallow water. And if he could get into the middle of the bay, he had a slightly better chance of surviving what he saw coming at him. Don Miller estimated the wave was traveling 130 miles an hour. When it passed Cenotaph Island in the middle of Lituya Bay. And he judged that from the amount of damage and the altitude that the timber was chopped off of the mountainside.
Interesting name, that Cenotaph Island.
Yeah. Well, Cenotaph is a grave marker.
Oh.
And the Frenchman La Perouse named it Cenotaph Island because while he was in there, he lost 21 men. In the tide rips at the entrance, because one of the things if you're planning a trip out to Lituya Bay, the main thing you need to take into account is the entrance, because an old coast pilot I dug up when I was researching the book I wrote about this trip, Walking Home, referred to it as the most justly feared harbor on the Pacific, because the ebb tide runs at up to 12 knots out of there, which creates standing combers all across the face that in a westerly swell it can break half a mile offshore. So you got to go in and out at slack water.
You have a pretty hair-raising description of your entrance into Lituya Bay when you went in to anchor down.
Well, I have a very light boat. I've got a light bow picker style boat that is fast, has plenty of power for it, but the weather had closed in on me when I was going up that way, and it was half a gale before I got there, and it was pretty lively, and it was very early in the year. It was in early May of 2007, which was when we had the most snow in history, but I was trying to make myself wait for slack water to get in there, but after getting beat up enough, I finally just turned around and headed in, and the difference between high tide and low tide there is so great that at low water from inside the bay, when the tide turns and starts coming in, you're actually looking up at sea level. Mm-hmm. So one Russian that sailed in there in the early 1800s recorded a wall of water 12 foot high that he sailed over going in there. You know, 2 fathoms is what he described it as.
It's like shooting a rapid.
it was not a standing wave, but just a bulge in the water, mm-hmm. because the water can't get in fast enough to stay level. You know, and I've seen that before when I was out there, where from the inside looking up, you're actually looking at the ocean outside higher than you. You know, during the flood, it's really kind of disorienting to see it.
Have you been back?
No, I haven't.
Yeah. Which raises the question of why did you go in the first place?
Well, it was
don't
all
tell
part
me
of,
because it was there.
That yeah, yeah, you'll have to read Walking Home to get that whole story. Yeah. You know, but it was something I'd kicked around for a long time, and I needed to go do a good solo trip, and that was the thing I had planned best for. That part of the coast had always fascinated me with its history. I'd been working on a novel based on that true event that took place out there in 1898 when some people were marooned and it turned into a lynching. But tonight's show is just about the bay itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've got some pretty dramatic and unique material for the show. I've got a bunch of slides that some of our Juneau old-timers took within days after the earthquake inside, and I've got recordings from the State Historical Library of the marine radio traffic between the boats immediately after the quake and the slide, including Howard Ulrich's voice on the Edrie from inside Lituya Bay as he prepares to come out. And like I say, if we have time, we'll see the short video from the BBC about how the forces of the landslide actually combined to make this wave that was greater than the sum of its parts.
So you have 3 books so far.
Four. Yeah.
Four. Okay. And the question is, are you working on anything right now?
No, I'm not. I'm just waiting for the muse to strike again, I guess.
Somebody said you have to go out and find the muse,
yeah.
Wrestle him to the ground and ask him what you're supposed to do next.
It's been taking a vacation lately,
yeah.
But we'll hope something will come up soon.
Well, after having read some of your stuff, I hope the muse gets back and drops in on your address.
You know, thank you.
You write exciting things,
yeah.
Including the wonderful scene in Walking where you're talking about the bear.
Well, tonight I'm going to actually read from Walking Home the section that's about the tsunami in 58. You know, that's really the focus of tonight's show. It's
right.
Until you see the magnitude of what happened there, you know, some graphics of it, it's really hard to imagine, like, say, sitting here talking about numbers, you know, over the air without any visuals. But some of the photos that the people at the State Historic Library helped me come up with, and Joel Curtis at the National Weather Service's Tsunami Early Warning Program, and Skip Gray are just, they really bring it home, what a magical enigma it is.
Yeah. Lynn Schooler, going to talk tonight at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, Fireside Lecture Series. There are 2 programs back-to-back. It's the same program each time. So
yeah.
If you're free at 6:30, drop out, take in the early show. That gives you the option of staying for the second if you want to, but the second one starts at 8 p.m. Folks, those are really popular lecture series, so go early enough to get a seat. If it gets into overflow, they actually have a way of showing the slides outside, but you don't get to see Lynn or hear him as well.
But everything that's up on the big screen will be shown on a monitor out in the foyer. And there's snacks and cookies and drinks and things for before the show and after.
Very, very
good. And I'll be selling copies of Walking Home afterwards.
Oh, yeah, and you're going to do
do a signing.
Do a signing like that. Okay, good enough. Lynn, thank you so much for coming and being on the show, and thank you so much for doing the talk tonight. It's a real opportunity to hear some stuff that we all ought to know a little more about Lituya Bay. Thank you.
I'm glad to do it. Thank you.
The Juneau Rotary Club presents their 13th annual wine tasting and auction, Friday, February 7th, 6 p.m. at the Jack. This 21 and over event features a variety of fine wines generously donated by K&L Distributors, Southern Odom Wine and Spirits, Odom Company, and Specialty Imports. The auction includes wines collected by Rotary members from all over the world. Proceeds support Rotary's UAS scholarships and community projects. Tickets available at 796-6569 and include a souvenir wine glass. Brought to you by the Juneau Rotary Club.
This is Bird Note. Where have the birds of summer gone? In July, you might have heard this dawn song, many birds singing at first light. Today, in winter, how utterly different the morning sounds. Where are the summer singers now? There's the flute-like song of a Swainson's thrush, a bird now wintering in Central and South America, maybe as far south as Bolivia. Catch the rhythmic notes of a warbling vireo, interspersed with lilting phrases of a black-headed grosbeak. Warbling vireos are now spread through much of Central America, while black-headed grosbeaks have migrated to Mexico. There's the descending trill of an orange-crowned warbler against a backdrop of robins. The warbler makes Mexico its winter home, as do some of the robins. Now the raspy Fitzbew song of a willow flycatcher. January finds it tucked away in Costa Rica or Panama. As winter turns to spring, these memorable singers will begin to fly north, where they will once again grace us with their rich dawn chorus. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
It's about 13 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next guest is Sean Eisla, and Sean is here to tell us about an opportunity to go see a whole bunch of really interesting short films on Monday and Tuesday evening at the Gold Town. They start at 7 p.m., and this is the Winter Wildlands Alliance Backcountry Film Festival. Quite a little mouthful there.
Yeah, that's right. It's on behalf of Discovery Southeast, so we're sponsoring it this year, putting it on at the Gold Town, and it's a great series of films. We start out with on Monday with I think about 8 shorts that are all kind of creative backcountry skiing, snowboarding, and adventure movies. A lot of good ski films, but also they're a little bit more on the interesting side. So a lot of fun themes there. And then the second part is a full-length ski film that's also a little bit more on the artistic and creative side called Valhalla.
So this festival has shown all over the world. We're really one of the last communities that picks it up. It starts out in Boise each year, I think in late November or something like that.
Correct.
And then shows all over. And the proceeds from this film series, when you pay your money, go to support a really fascinating program, which you just became the director of, I think.
That's right. Thanks. Yeah. Discovery Southeast. It's a fantastic program providing nature education for all of Juneau. We do a lot of programs in the schools with our nature studies program for third through fifth graders, teaching them to be curious and comfortable in the outdoors, and tons of other programs for kids, for teachers, and for adults, and publications, too.
We've had folks from Discovery Southeast on the show a couple of times talking about the kinds of activities, which a lot of them happen like after school. The students are assembled like at 3 in the afternoon or 3:30 in the afternoon, and then you go out on an adventure of some kind.
Yeah, we do have a program called the Discovery Days that takes students out during in-services. But actually, our main program is nature studies, and we work with the classroom teachers, and that's right in the classrooms, taking kids out and kind of teaching them how to be comfortable outdoors and hopefully leading to a lifelong passion and enjoyment.
The other thing I was noticing is that you've partnered up with a number of local authors, and if you go on your website and buy the book through your website, then a portion of the funds go to Discovery Southeast as well.
Yeah, that's right. Tom Lang books are on our website. We also actually have a lot of our own publications, including a lot of Richard Carstensen's publications that are on our website, and we're now selling those directly. So that's a great place to look at those. He came out with a new book this year, A Natural History of Juneau Trails, which is it's a pretty mind-blowing look at all of the natural watersheds in the trail system, and really takes you goes in depth and shows you about the natural history or the hydrology and the waters and the geologic features. We play in those every day, and after reading one of the pages about, say, the Perseverance Valley. It's just you're looking at it with a new set of eyes. It's really amazing.
Sean, the book needs to be encased in plastic. The temptation is too great to take it with you. You're going to have two copies, one for home and one for the backpack.
I think that's a great idea. I'd definitely buy two.
Good. And, of course, as we said, the money, a portion of the money goes to the author, but a portion of the money goes to fund these same programs that the Wild Lions Alliance Backcountry Film Festival tickets are going to do. So, once again, it's Monday and Tuesday night. It's at the Gold Town Theater. It's at 7 p.m. Some of the films sound absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, one of the shorts that sounds most interesting to me is Bigger and Braver. That's a short documentary on a young female athlete who shares her insight into the courage and strength involved in seeking big mountain adventure. That's one that I'm looking forward to. Valhalla, of course, is supposed to be a great movie, and that has some really interesting segments too.
Good enough. Folks, great opportunity. Go out, watch some films, support Discovery Southeast. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you, Pat.
Our December Writers Showcase was a success, and now we are accepting submissions for our March 6th show. Our spring-inspired theme is Awakenings. If you have a piece, know of a piece, or want to compose a short story or essay that is between 5 and 12 minutes long, please contact us at arts@ktoo.org. The deadline for submissions is February 14th. Check out the Writers Showcase page at 360north.org for more information.
It's time once again for Juno Cabaret. This is an exciting little thing that goes on. I've got Tom Loker and Laura Haywood here to bring us up to speed on this one. This is where a whole bunch of the incredibly talented singers in Juno get together on the second floor of the Rockwell building and sing their hearts out for the enjoyment and entertainment of the guests in the Rockwell ballroom.
Yep, that's right. We do it every few months, and our next one is this Sunday, January 26th, 7 p.m. at Rockwell, and it's pay as you can, so there should be no barrier to coming.
Yeah. So who all's singing and who all's dancing? And
Well, it's great to be here. Wait a minute.
Okay. You're turned on now.
Okay, it's great to be here on a Juno afternoon again, Pat. Thanks for having us back. And, yeah, we have great talent this time. I'll talk a little bit about the accompanist. I'll be accompanying six of the singers, and maybe a seventh. Robert Cohen will be an accompanist, Sandra DeLong, Jackie Farnsworth, and Jim Knoll for the very first time, and we're very excited to have Jim be accompanist for Juno Cabaret. He's been playing behind Doug Bridges for the last few years a lot and doesn't accompany singers much, so we're very happy to have him with us accompanying John Haywood.
Correct.
And David Shakely is going to be our drummer this time. He's been in every single Juno Cabaret show, I think. So
not 9 years, I think?
No. We're coming up on 5 years.
Five. Okay.
Yeah.
We're pretty excited about that.
Yeah. 2009 is when it all started. Uh-huh. So maybe that's where nine came from.
That's where my head was.
Yeah, this Sunday, the 26th, upstairs at Rockwell, beginning at 7. And the singers have prepared long and hard for this. Each one sings two numbers. And Laura will talk a little bit about how the show works.
Well, maybe I should just run through the singers, just in case someone...
Well, I hope so.
Yeah. So here's the list in alphabetical order. Miss Becky Bear, Jack Brandt, Elizabeth Bryson, she's one of our teenagers this time.
Yep.
Julie Cozy, who's joining us from Haynes, John Haywood, Ronnie Jackson Bear, Tom Melville, everybody knows Tom from Capital Copy, Bobby Mitchell, John Neary, he's one of our first-timers, Marcia Souza, Salisa Thole, Taylor Vittich, who is an awesome singer, they all are, and Greg Williams and Ardeen Womack.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, each person comes up for two songs and introduces the next person. The show runs usually, what, a couple of hours, Tom?
Yeah, 1 hour and a half to 2 hours.
Yeah.
We're so pleased to have Julie Cozy join us for this show. She's down from Haynes to do a different performance on Saturday, and I'm really glad to have her on the bill for Juno Cabaret. She's been able to perform two times before, so we're really pleased to have her back a third time. This is actually, I believe, our 15th performance and our fifth one at the Rockwell Ballroom, which is a very nice space to have the Juno Cabaret. Everybody can see and hear, and it's comfortable.
It is.
mm-hmm. food and drink
well,
is available.
Well, this is kind of unusual. Actually, Rockwell got a little overextended, and we're going to bring our own food this time. But
oh, okay.
I promise there will be plenty of it. And we won't actually have a bar, but next time, by next time, they will be completely renovated and open and ready to host us all the way. So we'll just have a little bit more making do, and then...
a lot of us are really looking forward to that renovation being finished, because they were so marvelous when they first took over and brought the Elks Club into new management and just mm-hmm. really brought in a totally different approach.
It's nice to have things going on both floors of a building, a downtown building, and it's a great performance space upstairs. We're pleased to be back there again. There's a little stage at one end, so we have a place to put the drum kit and piano and the singers. There's lighting. So it's a good setting for the singers and some of our first-timers in Juno Cabaret this time, Salisa Tole and Elizabeth Bryson and then John Neary. I think it'll be great for them to hear the other singers, the beginners and the veterans, and they all learn from one another, watching one another, and everybody gets to hear everybody else's material too. And they've all brought some great songs for Juno Cabaret. We try and have the singers emphasize at least one of their numbers from American musical theater or American songbook, and many are doing that. And it's great also for the teenagers and the younger singers, the 20-somethings, to hear selections from the American songbook, because they immediately grow to like those songs, and then they want to perform them, and that's a good way to keep that music interesting, keep it going.
Tom, are you working with any of the first-timers this time?
Yes, yeah. Salisa Tole, but she's appeared with me in another production before. But Elizabeth Bryson, this is her very first time, and her piano teacher, Mary DeSmet, contacted Laura and me about Elizabeth. And she came and watched the last cabaret, and we asked her, do you think you would like to do something like that sometime? And she was persuaded, so she's performing two numbers, one pop song, and then an old-timer called How High the Moon.
Okay. One of my favorite songs. I'm glad she's doing that.
So when you start working with her, first of all, how long do you take to prep together?
Oh, well, typically I meet with each singer three times, unless it's a veteran with a lot of material. Like Julie, I'll meet with her once, probably. But one meeting is real short, where we just discuss what singing they've done before, and we pick songs and keys that might work.
Okay.
The second time, we narrow down our choices and come up with an arrangement for the two songs, and then the final time is our run-through. Arrangement means how many times through and how the beginning and end works, and whether or not we modulate to a different key or something like that.
Yeah.
Or maybe change tempos or rhythms in the middle of the song. Try and do that sometimes. So.
Yeah. The construction or the preparation for this has got to be fantastic. It'd be really nice if somehow you could be part of that as well as part of the performance.
It's surprising how many people like to watch the rehearsals and are interested in the creative process. I had no idea that people were interested in that part of preparing a cabaret singer. But when friends and family come with people to rehearsal and watch, they always say how much they enjoy that part.
Yep. Yep. Okay, so the show is...
Sunday night, the 26th.
At 7 o'clock?
Yes,
yep.
Begins
okay.
at 7.
Okay.
Upstairs at Rockwell, 109 South Franklin, the former location of the Elks Hall.
Good. Fantastic.
Thanks so much.
Oh, hey, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about this thing. Hey, this is KTOO FM in Juneau. We are broadcasting on a set of translators throughout the area, K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley in Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, we're on GCI Cable Digital Channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org, and support for our national programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and thank you very much from listeners like you. So on Monday, we will have Juneau Afternoon. Joan Partis will drop in to host, and we'll be hearing about the new wine bar that's come in at Silver Bow Inn, an exciting new development downtown. CBJ Activities, City Manager Kim Kiefer, a regular feature. There's a concert of the California Guitar Trio and the Montreal Guitar Trio. We heard a cut from them earlier on the program, and they will be coming in for a Monday night concert. She'll be talking to them. And the BBBS School Mentoring Program, Dirk Miller and Gretchen Durking will drop in to explain what that is. Thank you so much for joining me on Juno Afternoon today. I've enjoyed being your host, and thank you, Juno.